Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. On Author Chats, we feature in-depth conversations with writers about their recent works. And today, we are honored to have with us attorney James D. Zirin to talk about his compelling new book, Supremely Partisan, How Raw Politics Tips the Scales in the United States Supreme Court. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Elizabeth. Great to be with you again.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back. Regular listeners of this show will remember that about a year ago, Jim was on to talk about his then new book called The Mother Court. But Supremely Partisan is every bit as interesting and encourage everyone to read it. Jim, basically, the theme of your book is that the justices on the United States Supreme Court are partisan. They are political creatures. And because of this, their decisions are shaped. And because of this political bent, the American public is gradually losing confidence in the Supreme Court as an institution. Has it always been this way?
Well, it certainly started with Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was an appointee of Theodore Roosevelt, a Republican, and he was linked closely with Louis D. Brandeis, who was an appointee of Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat. But they were known as the Great Dissenters, and they voted together. So there was a certain amount of nonpartisan joinder among these two leading justices. But Holmes did believe that judges make the law. They don't make the law in the sense that legislators make the law. They make the law in the sense that the law is not some brooding omnipresence up in the sky that the judge discovers, but they mold and craft the law based on precedent and then also based on their experience. The court seemed to become much more partisan in 1986 with the appointment of Justice Scalia, and there arose a tendency, particularly of Republican presidents, to appoint justices for their ideology. So you pretty soon had a number of conservative seats that were filled on the court in the administrations of Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and eventually George W. Bush, so that the court, prior to the death of Justice Scalia, was five conservatives and four liberals, five Republican appointees, four Democratic appointees. And now that Scalia is gone, we have a tie, four liberals, four conservatives, and we have to see what develops.
A few moments ago, you mentioned Justice Brandeis. And Supremely Partisan has a good deal of wonderful history in it, and I learned a good deal. And in particular, I was struck by the bitter, violent opposition to Justice Brandeis' appointment to the High Court. Is there anything we can do to make the appointment process less partisan?
Well, I think only through public pressure on the United States Senate, but the senators don't appear to be listening to the American people, who would, I think, prefer to see justices confirmed on the basis of their competence, just as Chief Justice Roberts said, not on the basis of their ideology. And so you now have the block that the Senate has imposed on Merrick Garland, certainly a highly qualified candidate, Obama's nominee to the court, and on purely partisan grounds, namely that Majority Leader McConnell in the Senate thinks that the next justice should be elected by the American people, although that's not what the Constitution says.
A slight problem. If you've just tuned in, we're talking with James D. Zirin about his book, Supremely Partisan, How Raw Politics Tips the Scales in the United States Supreme Court. Jim is a prolific writer, and we talked to him about a year ago about his book, The Mother Court, which is the history of the federal court in the Southern District of New York. And Jim, if our listeners want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
A in a circle, Jim Zirin, Z-I-R-I-N.
There you have it. Now, on page 75 of your book, you make a very interesting statement, and you say that the United States Supreme Court is now 100% minority. Now, depending upon how you measure minority-majority status, by my count, there are currently 4 white males on the high court. How can you make that statement?
Well, the court now consists of 5 Catholics and 4 Jews. Before Scalia's death, 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. The court historically had been appointed by was dominated by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males. Of the 112 justices, 89 were white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males. Now we have no white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, no white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males on the court, and they're all Catholics. We have 5 Catholics and 3 Jews who consist of the bench.
Now, a few moments ago, you mentioned the sudden passing of Justice Scalia. As a practical matter, what does 8 justices on the court mean for decision making?
Well, it increases, Elizabeth, the possibility of a tie vote 4-4, which means that the decision of the lower court is left undisturbed, and the decision of the Supreme Court, in that they were deadlocked, has no precedential value whatsoever. Now, in the 19th century, there were 10 justices on the court. Congress cut it back to 9 as an economy measure. So there's no magic to having an odd number. The court is shorthanded at the moment. But there have been 5 instances since Scalia's death where they've deadlocked 4-4, and in 3 of them relatively important cases. Those cases left the decision of the lower court undisturbed. One related to immigration, one related to unions, and the third one related to voter ID laws in North Carolina.
One of the terms that you use in the book is identity politics. What does that mean as to a Supreme Court justice? And are identity politics necessarily a bad thing?
Well, historically, we've used identity politics throughout our political system. Most of your listeners are probably not New Yorkers, but some may remember the way New York local political tickets were formed, with Lefkowitz, Gilhooly, and Fino running against Procaccino, Beam, and O'Connor. So you chose one from Group A and one from Group B. Basically, we had this continue in appointments to the Supreme Court because we had a Catholic seat. Of course, that started in the mid-19th century with the appointment by Andrew Jackson of Chief Justice Roger Taney. And we had it with a Jewish seat, which started with Brandeis and continued with Abe Fortas. We no longer have a seat concept, obviously, because we have 5 Catholics on the bench, and we have 3 Jews on the bench.
Is it possible for a justice to escape his or her background? And in particular, one of the reasons why I ask that is you seem, quite frankly, to admire the work and the decisions of Justice Sotomayor, as many, if not most, people do. And she is very, very much a product of her upbringing, her Puerto Rican background in the Bronx.
Yes, unabashedly.
You refer to her as the people's justice.
Yes, unabashedly so, and I think that's consistent with what Holmes said, that the life of the law is not logic but experience. And Sotomayor's life experience has been very different from that of the other justices on the court, with the exception, perhaps, of Clarence Thomas, because both grew up minority, both grew up poor, and yet they come out exactly the opposite way, ideologically, on the policy issues that come before the court. So you can't always predict how a judge is going to vote based on their background and experience, but often it's a very telling factor.
And then, by the same token, you tend to criticize Justice Scalia for his very conservative Catholic background, and in particular, you talk about the disconnect between that background and the stances he would take on many social justice issues, including capital punishment.
Yes, well, Justice Scalia stated off the bench that his views on capital punishment were dictated by Catholic theology. He cited St. Paul in the New Testament and said, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And he said the state is the emissary of the Lord, and the state has a right to take a life is retribution. Now, the Constitution itself refers in two places in the Fifth Amendment to capital punishment, but it also refers to cruel and unusual punishments. So the court has come to analyze closely whether punishments are cruel and whether they're unusual based on today's standards, not the standards in 1789 or 1791. In 1791, we hanged people for stealing horses. In 1791, if you kissed your spouse in public on a Sunday, they put you in the stocks. I think most judges would say that those punishments today are cruel and unusual.
Final question for you. As I said earlier, you are a prolific writer. What is your next project?
I haven't totally decided. One agent told me that I should write a sexy novel, but I haven't really given that any serious thought.
But so I take it that your next work is going to be nonfiction again.
Not necessarily. Yes, quite probably, but not necessarily.
All right. We've been talking with James D. Zirin about his new book, Supremely Partisan, How Raw Politics Tips the Scales in the United States Supreme Court. I'm Elizabeth Kelly, and you've been listening to Author Chats. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere.